Welcome back to Plot Pit, where we forge fiction from fact and folklore. Back for round three, author trilogy, Richard Polinelli on the phone. Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to it. Kind of the finish line in sight, but it's been a lot of fun. I'm glad you guys had me on.
Oh, it has been a blast. And we learned a lot about you as an author and your work at Tuscany Bay Books in the previous episode, folks. If you want to catch that, hit the rewind button and come back. We gave a teaser of what we're talking about today, Confederate Air Force.
That's right. We've done airships a lot on this show, but this time, they were typically alien airships, but this time it's got to be human airships.
Human airships.
That's the rule. It's got to be humans because all the stories are human-based instead of alien-based.
Okay. So let's begin the descent. Confederate Air Force, human-based. John, introduce us to our material.
So even though we're eventually going to go back to the Civil War, we're going to start in the late 1960s in Houston, Texas. There was this house, old house, slated for demolition because it was a fire hazard and they were cleaning it out. And they find these notebooks in the attic. There's probably about a dozen or more of them. And they appear to be notebooks or scrapbooks on the history of aviation. But it's not the history of aviation as we know it. It tells the tale of this thing called the Sonora Aero Club from California that was formed back in the 1850s. It comprised mostly of German immigrants, along with a few immigrants also from Mexico, Spain, and a few Americans. So it was kind of a secret society, and their secretary or record keeper, his name was Charles Del Shaw. And some people listening probably immediately know now what I'm talking about, Del Shaw's airship books. So Del Shaw's scrapbooks, they tell the saga of this airship club in Sonora, California, again, 1850s. The notebooks, I mean, they could be a fictional story he was writing, but he writes it as though it's a real notebook and this is real history. And he basically claims that there was this wild inventor named Peter Minnis who had invented an anti-gravity formula, and that's how he got these airships to fly. And the books are just full of drawings of these airships, very complicated, detailed drawings. And again, there's a dozen of them. And you have to wonder who is going to be bored enough to do like a dozen books on fake history that aren't really going to be published or anything like that. So these books, though, again, they're discovered in the late 1960s. Several different researchers have looked at them and tried to figure out, you know, is this telling a real story or what? So I'm just reading, it's coming from me and Noe Torres' book, The Real Cowboys and Aliens, The Lost Cases. We did a chapter on Del Shaw, and his notebooks contained illustrations for no less than 100 airships with names like Aero Trump, Aero Mary, Aero Jordan, to name just a few. The drawings show equipment way ahead of its time for the 1850s, including advanced generators, gliding keels, revolving propellers, and most impressive of all, retractable landing gear. And so, again, you know, people have puzzled over these books for many years. And, you know, Del Shaw, he was long dead. He died in the 1920s by the time these books were found in the 1960s. But Del Shaw, he, in one of his passages, he wrote, "Wonder Weaver, you will unriddle my writings." So that people think there's some sort of a code hidden in these notebooks about the airships.
This really brings out in my head the Coral Castle guy. He's basically riddled his Coral Castle with prime numbers and basically says, hey, if you figure this out, then you'll understand how I did it.
Oh, that's right. So that could be the anti-gravity formula.
Yeah. And we have Nikola Tesla about the same time, right? There's rumors that he tapped into that. And then, of course, Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla, you know, that famous conflict between the two. And you could end up having, you know, I mean, as the conspiracy theory is out there, Edison and the U.S. government shut down Tesla because he had a completely different idea on electricity and magnetism. Interesting thoughts just all collecting together right there.
I'm gonna throw one in. Okay. I'm going to throw one in just in case. The notebooks were written in what year?
They were written, I think he composed the notebooks either, I think it was after the club folded around 1860.
Okay. So I would toss in as an element, just because I'm odd that way, the Aurora, Texas UFO crash of 1897.
Yeah, we can definitely work in the 1897.
You're familiar with that one?
Yeah, because there was tons of airship sightings in 1897.
Mm-hmm. This one is a object that crashed in this town of Aurora, and there was not I mean, there's debris everywhere, but they couldn't figure out why or how it was airborne. They buried the lone pilot. And then when people started trying to find out what was buried at the cemetery, they moved the body or whatever was buried there. I was just kind of, it went to that as maybe somebody who got a hold of the notebooks in the 1890s and tried to build an airship, and it didn't go so well.
Oh, yeah. Good thought. Good thought. And there's tons of airship stories to play with, and we might throw a few more in there, too. Mm-hmm. Now, to go to the Confederate Air Force before we proceed and really cook up a story, this is apparently real. I mean, they never got their Air Force off the ground, but there were plans for it. So let me look in. I got this in Noe and I's book, The Lost Cases, as well. So this came to light in 2011 when papers and blueprints belonging to a Confederate inventor named Dr. R. Finley Hunt came up for auction, and they sold for a little over $20,000. And they actually show that he was drawing up blueprints for steam-powered airships with which to wage war on the Union Army.
Was it more of a balloon-type situation, or was this supposed to be something just powered by steam that flew?
So these were supposed to be steam-powered dirigibles. And
okay.
So I'm looking. So apparently this Dr. Hunt sent his design to the Confederate President Jefferson Davis, who thought enough of them that he did forward them along to General Robert E. Lee. And Lee, you know, having some experience in engineering, he sent them to a Colonel Jeremy F. Gilmer, chief of the Engineer Bureau for the Confederacy. And Gilmer was the one who didn't have any faith in it and basically just let the project die. So his opinion was the engine to make the craft become airborne would be so heavy that it would be impossible for the craft to become airborne. So he just canceled it. So there were plans for a Civil War era Air Force that just didn't ever come to fruition.
Kind of reminds me of the Vincent Price movie Master of the World.
Yeah, I do remember that. And it's based on a Jules Verne story, right?
I believe so.
So what could
Robert is the name of the character. Okay. I think it was Jules Verne.
I want to hit on the feasibility of the physics behind the engine weighing too much relative to being able to get the thing off the ground, okay?
Yeah.
Modern day locomotives in the rail industry are diesel powered, but the mechanisms that move the locomotive is electric. So what you've got is the diesel turning a turbine, which a generator creates the electricity, which then is used to actually propel the locomotive down the tracks. So we've got the steam-powered engine that is driving the mechanism for the anti-gravity device. So there's your physics to make it all work. This is why, in some cases, people didn't understand how to make it work, right? And other people did. And there was kind of the secret of the anti-gravity component. And other people were like seeing the steam-powered thing and trying to figure out how to get that to work. And it wouldn't work because they were missing this other side of the equation.
Right.
So what kind of story are we going to make out of it? Because we've got Confederate Air Force, potentially. We've got the Sonoran Air Club, which predated that. And then we've got the airship wave of the late 1890s, which can also tie into the Spanish-American War that began in 1898, if you want. I'm just throwing it in there.
We got to figure if it is just a balloon type, it's only going to have a certain top speed, which makes it easy to shoot at. So do we build something where, you know, it's one or two pilots and they got one bomb to drop and then they get out of there? Or is this where you're transporting troops? I mean, there's so many different ways you could do it once you figure out how to get the thing airborne. So I think we would have to figure out what would be the purpose of it that, for example, he said the one officer just, disregarded it because he couldn't figure out a way to make it, worth doing. So we would have to come up with a reason why they would go that way and try to figure out why they would go ahead and say yes. Yeah, I mean, this is going to be an interesting one to put together.
You mentioned troop transport.
Yeah.
And my thought there is the South is trying to plan an invasion of Washington. And with balloons being silent, effectively, right? They're thinking that they can transport a sizable army throughout the evening across a large vast of distance where the Union Army has set up, say, a perimeter, And then they're thinking, mm-hmm. hey, if we can get 50 miles behind the perimeter and drop down in Washington, we can end the war.
Yeah, I mean, that would be one mission. In fact, it'd probably be the one that they would think it would be worth trying, especially, say, like toward the end of the war, where, you know, they have one last gasp effort to swing things around and win. We were talking about transporting. The two capitals at the time were Richmond and D.C., and they're only about 110 miles apart. So a balloon, if it could do, I have no idea what the top speed of a balloon is, but let's give it about 10 to 12 miles an hour. They could take off just at sunset, and they could be in D.C. before the sun came up. And maybe the mission is to get enough of their people there unseen, land in D.C., and capture the White House and most of the government and force a surrender. If they were desperate enough to think that they could pull that off and hold, you know, the Capitol long enough to force it. So I would probably go that way as far as making it a kind of a last gasp, save the Confederacy mission, where once they figure out how to get that much weight up and get it moving where they want to go, that would be the story there, would be to try to do that and then use the same technology in other places to get behind enemy lines and attack from the rear and get them in a almost like a crossfire, but kind of pinch them from both sides and force surrenders there. I mean, that would be, you know, I'm not in the military, but to me, that would seem to be a military purpose worth trying to do this.
So I think, yeah, that's perfect. That's the Confederate bad guy's goal. And the hero has to keep them from getting Del Shao's papers, because when they get Del Shao's papers, they can copy the anti-gravity formula and actually make that happen. So I think that's like the Del Shao papers are the MacGuffin that the hero, mm-hmm. whoever he is, has to keep them from getting. Maybe just for the sake of making it interesting, they do get at least one of the papers or something, and they're able to make one test airshipped, and then the climax of the story, movie, whatever, would be the hero fighting the bad guys on this airship, maybe that's on its way to Washington, and he manages to crash it before it gets there, and that's the big bang that kind of ends the movie.
Yeah, he'd even do it where he has to kind of sacrifice himself to keep this from happening.
Yeah.
If I was the reader, my thought would be, they've already created the prototype and the battle just kills the prototype. What about all the individuals who actually built the device, and where's the paper so we can prevent or ensure that there's not a second one coming?
I think if you did it late enough in the war, this one either works or we lose type situation, so that they don't have time to build a new model and try anything after that. The surrender happens before they can try a second time. And then you could kind of lead it to where whoever's got the papers still tries to build the device, maybe not for Civil War purposes, but he's trying to build it. And that's why you see some of these airship sightings.
That's a believable ending. It's late enough in the war where they've got the one balloon. I don't think then that it's a troop movement to try to capture the Union government. I think then it would be the Confederacy trying to capture Lincoln, which mm-hmm. would then go into John Wilkes Booth.
Yeah.
So John Wilkes Booth is one of the individuals that's part of this plan, right?
There was the Knights of the Golden Circle, so that's perfect, and he was part of that, along with Jesse James. So you could make Knights of the Golden Circle your subgroup of Confederate bad guys.
And mm-hmm. so the hero in the action sequence is able to crash the dirigible, which ends that threat. The war ends because it's so late, it's kind of the last hurrah. Lee surrenders, and Booth and the Knights of the
Golden Circle,
the Knights of the Golden Circle, are dead set on their mission of taking out Lincoln. And so that leads into the alternate history, or the explanation for the motives of John Wilkes Booth and the assassination of Lincoln that happened in 1863.
Yep, that would work.
Yeah, I think we did it. I think that's, you know, you got a lot of fantastic elements. You know, you got the airships, the intrigue with the spies, action. You know, it's got everything it needs, I'd say.
Yeah, I think so. Clearly, it's an action-based thriller type novel or movie or, you know, video game, if you were to go that route.
Yeah.
So a lot of elements.
And you have plenty of Union spies who are operating in the Confederate areas. and actively doing things in like Richmond and in Charleston. So you could draw on any one of them as far as being the one who uncovers the plot. You might even probably find one that didn't survive the war and use him if you want to, or you could use one of them to set up the agent who does go in and stop the plan and doesn't survive the attempt. The thing about doing alternate history is you can have a whole lot of fun. As long as you do the deep dive into the research, you can find these little things that you can add that will make sense in your alternate history and still not be in direct conflict with the history that we know.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who did that really well was Robert Sawyer. The book is called The Oppenheimer Alternative. And he took testimony and events that actually happened, doesn't change anything, but adds things that were going on in the background that completely changes what everybody was doing at the time, as opposed to what we think they were doing at the time. It's one of the best alternate history books I've ever read. And the way he's able to do that, to where you think that either history could be the real one, up until the very end when he terraforms Mars. But I mean, that's, you know, but for most of the book, you're thinking the alternate history is as likely as the real history. If I ever do an alternate history, I hope I do it as a tenth as good as Robert Sawyer did.
I'm looking this up now on Amazon. It's really fascinating. The blurb here. After the war ends, Oppenheimer's physicist combines forces with Albert Einstein, computing pioneer John Neumann, and rocket designer Wernher von Braun, the greatest scientific geniuses from the last century, racing against time to save our future.
Mm-hmm. It's an incredible book. If you get a chance to read it, you really should.
Are you familiar with this one, John?
No, I've never heard of it.
It takes events, the reason why Oppenheimer was kind of run off, and puts a different spin on the real reason why he was run off. It's just amazing how he did it in such a way that, like I said, you will spend most of the book wondering, okay, is the history I know real, or is this the real history? And the history I thought I know is the alternate. You know, it's just amazing how he did that, to take events and not change them, but at the same time, change them, change their meaning to where they mean something completely different. If you want to do alternate history, read that book. That's a master class on how to do it.
You know, John, we do a lot of alternate history type stuff here on the show.
Yeah, I'd say that's predominantly what we do in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Robert, if you're listening, he and I have talked in the past. So, Robert, if you're listening, you now owe me at least 10% of all book sales from this point forward. For that plug right there. No, it's a great book. And it's one of the things that makes alternate history so fascinating, is that you can take the what if. What if this didn't happen? What if this happened instead? What if, you know, this person was in this place instead of that person? And then you can kind of play it out and try to figure out, and then tell the story and see if people think that, yeah, that might have worked or not. I talk with a historian all the time, and we do this all the time. We pick a point in history. Well, what if this had happened instead? And then we kind of play out how the following years and decades would have played out. And it's fun to see what we come up with.
You know, we played with that in the first Pit episode with you, Richard, the time traveler, the Somerton Man, right? We took that element and then hypothesized the choose your own adventure books, going back through history and asking the question, you know, as the reader, what would you do and how might that play out?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fun area to write in. Yeah. You need to do a lot of research, make sure you don't mess up anything as far as what actually happened. So that way, when you change things, you know, people will buy into it. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun to kind of game that stuff out. And, you know, more often than not, you come up with a good story.
Now, sometimes, Richard, we like at the end of the episode for our guests to kind of recap the story as we created it. Would you be willing to do that with our little airship thing we constructed?
Yeah, I'm going to let you do that, because we were throwing so much stuff in there. I've kind of lost track on what we've put in and what we left out.
Okay, so the recap, that I, as I remember it, is We have the Sonora Airship Club of the 1850s, which is mostly good guys. They're just scientists who want to experiment and push the boundaries of technology. And one of them creates an anti-gravity formula, and they disband. And I'm going to say maybe they disband. In fact, when they start to hear rumblings of the Civil War, that's something I'm adding in right now. And then the Civil War does erupt a few years later. And towards the waning years of the Civil War, the Confederate Army has plans for an Air Force, which fails with that guy, Doc. I can't remember his name. He was a real guy. Guess it doesn't matter in our fictional story anyways. But so those plans fail, but they like the idea of a Confederate Air Force. And somebody knows about guys from the Sonora Air Club, their note taker, Del Shao. And so the Confederates, it becomes a race against time for the Confederates and the Union spies to find Del Shao and make sure that nobody steals his notes. But, you know, because it's a movie, the bad guys have to get an edge towards the end. They will steal his notes, and they manage to construct just one test airship, which they plan to pilot to Washington, D.C. and do a sneak attack on the city. But our hero, the Union spy, he manages to stop it at the last minute, and he crashes the airship. Maybe he dies with it, maybe he doesn't. Didn't really decide that part, but the day is saved, and these airships never came to be. I think that's basically what we did.
I think so.
That sounds about right.
All right, well, folks, we are out of time, but we have been on the phone with an outstanding guest that basically just made all of our story elements super easy and almost cracked it out within the first 5 minutes. Yeah. Richard Polinelli, what a blast to watch your creative mind in action.
Well, sometimes people look at me when I'm doing stuff and they just wonder, you know, what I drink or what I take to do this stuff. But it's a lot of fun to craft a story, especially when you're just bringing in elements, you know, on the fly like we've done. Yeah. I had a lot of fun doing this. You know, even if you don't write the story eventually, just doing these kind of exercises is something every writer should do from time to time. Just kind of stretch out and just have some fun with it. And I definitely had a whole lot of fun.
No, we did too. Thank you.
And thank you for your time today, Richard. It's been a pleasure to have you. You're welcome back on the show anytime.
Well, thank you for having me on. And I know we're going to get together a little later and talk about the being a publisher at Tuscany Bay. So I'm looking forward to doing that with you guys.
Yes, we will get that scheduled soon. So listeners, be out on the listening platform if you're interested, either on our website or any one of the podcast services such as Spotify or Amazon. If you are potentially interested in learning more about Richard's publishing company, Tuscany Bay Books. In the meantime, if you have show submission ideas, just want to provide us feedback or potentially be on the program, send us an email, submissions@plotpit.com. You can catch us out on Discord and interact with our esteemed friend Richard Polinelli. Perhaps ask him nicely for spoilers of his upcoming books. He might give them to you. We also have other authors such as Justina Luther and Declan Finn who have also been on this program. We will be posting content to YouTube very shortly. I know I've been teasing that. It is coming, I promise. Twitch live stream also on the way in the next couple of weeks. John, I think that basically wraps it up.
I believe so.
All right. Well, folks, thank you for beginning the descent with us. I'm William Atkinson.
John LeMay.
And again, Richard, thank you for your time.
Thanks, guys.
All right. We'll catch you around.